It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to another episode of Purple Insider. Matthew Collar here, along with CBS Sports draft analyst Chris Trapasso, for one more show before we close the door on draft season. And I got to say, Chris, what a draft season it was. Unlike any other that we have gone through. We flirted with the quarterback conversation through the years, but this year we knew it was going to happen. We broke it down in every possible way that we could, including an episode people should go back and look at where you talked about JJ McCarthy tape and you watched back his best game and we went through it. So that's one to go back and look at for what we said about JJ McCarthy. But this is one of our favorite episodes every year. It's become a tradition where we have you break down and analyze every single pick. Usually the Vikings have more than this, but we'll go through it. I've got some major topics from the draft to ask you about for the rest of the league as well. So I'm excited for this, but the first thing I got to know from you is, how do you grade the Vikings drafting JJ McCarthy with the 10th overall pick?
I definitely did a Twitter thread in real time for the first round that I do every year. So I just ultimately can look back and say I've graded every single pick in the draft, because I do those for CBS Sports from rounds two through Mr. Irrelevant. Pete Prisco's on those for the actual website in the first round. So I just do it on Twitter. I don't remember the specific grade I gave, but I know it was in the A range. I mean, the trade up one pick and, you know, giving away some selections, I didn't just in a vacuum love that. But we've talked about it. Anyone listening to this podcast over the last, like you mentioned, like 3 years, knows how I think and how you think about, hey, if you need to get your quarterback and if it's one pick, you don't say, oh, well, we didn't want to trade that 2025 third rounder or whatever to move up one spot to get our guy. Then I think that's kind of silly. So I think A minus you have to give it, because he's younger, 2 years younger than some of the top prospects in this class. The upside is there. I mean, I didn't meet him. I haven't talked to him. I don't know him. But apparently everything that he does with his charisma and his leadership and the X's and O's are all certainly there. And I think that really aligns well with what we talked about this entire draft process, you know, having a former quarterback, head coach, having Josh McCown there. He's going to understand concepts and understand, hey, look, maybe we're going to have this be your first read, but maybe the second read is actually the better option given this coverage or situation. And he just has big time talent. I think he was kind of undersold that, oh, he's not really that special of an athlete. He doesn't have a great arm. I think he is a good athlete. He can be awkward at times, but then he can also do ridiculous things off structure. And I think he's got a pretty big arm that could only get better, because again, he is only 21 years old. He comes in, interestingly, that young, but having played a lot of football and played in a lot of big games. And no, he was never the guy throwing for 500 yards in those games, but there was the throw late in the game in the national title against Washington over the middle. There were big plays against Alabama's Nick Saban defense in the Rose Bowl, beating Ohio State multiple times, never easy, where JJ McCarthy did make some big time throws in those games. So I think maybe they wanted Drake May, maybe Michael Penix. You probably know more about that than I do, but I think landing on JJ McCarthy is like a perfectly sound fit for where this organization is and where they want to go.
And I was so close. I was so close to nailing it by saying for the last few weeks that they could stick at 11. And honestly, if they hadn't allowed the Denver Broncos.
I thought it was going to happen. Yeah, yeah.
I know. They let the Denver Broncos scare them a little bit into it. Clearly, the one thing we can say is that they were a lot more comfortable with McCarthy than they were Bo Nix. So they decided to make that move and just box out. Like, let's spend a late round pick to move up and box out the Broncos so they don't jump over us. But then the Broncos admitted to, like, they weren't going to do that. They wanted Bo Nix the entire time. And everybody got to be right in some ways about this draft, which was for a long time, Nix and the Broncos were connected together. That ended up coming to fruition. The Vikings with JJ McCarthy, all these extremely natural fits. The only one that threw us off was number 8 to the Falcons, which we'll get into with you a little bit later. But one thing I was thinking about a lot as they were drafting McCarthy, talking about McCarthy, is how rare it is that a player without either insane tools or an insane resume comes out at his age. Normally, if it's somebody like him, he would stay in for another year, but he had the, I guess, instinct that, all right, Jim Harbaugh's leaving and we just won the national championship, and this is the best time for me to come out and be in the NFL, even if I have to sit a year, almost like an NBA prospect would be nowhere ready to play in the NBA at age 18 or 19, but they would rather come out, get into the NBA system rather than running it back with a coach who wouldn't let him throw the ball against Penn State when he was the head coach for that game and Jim Harbaugh wasn't there. And you lose an incredible team around you pretty much entirely to the draft. So if you come back next year and the circumstances aren't as good, like, this was good timing for JJ McCarthy. But normally when I think of a 20-year-old finishing his last college season and turning 21, I think of, well, the guy's got to have freakish tools. He's got to be massive or have giant numbers to come out. And what that does for McCarthy is makes him harder to predict. It's already hard enough for us to predict what's going to happen with these quarterbacks once they get to the NFL. But with McCarthy, that was something that the Vikings talked about, is the unknown element of JJ McCarthy. And they worked extremely hard to try to resolve this within their process, meeting with him, looking at the film in certain ways, trying to section it out and break it down to the NFL throws and all this sorts of stuff that they would do to try to resolve this issue. But at the end of the day, that, I believe, is one of the main reasons why McCarthy was not somebody who was taken in the top five, why teams did not try to jump all the way up to 6 or 5 or 4 with huge offers. And probably the Vikings as well, based on their comments and how they laid it out, is that they thought, we probably can stay here and wait for him, because if an NFL team is putting a top 10 draft pick down on a quarterback, it's such a huge investment. And other teams were not trying to get that far up for somebody who had so many unknowns.
Yeah, and I think that's all spot on, and that is probably why he did drop a little bit, because he didn't tick those boxes of, oh, this is just a project with freaky traits, or this is a guy that threw for 18,000 yards in college. What's interesting, though, and I mentioned it earlier, he still started 28 games. This is not like he's Mark Sanchez or Mitch Trubisky that was like an 8-game starter or a 12-game starter, like, and barely played, and we just saw 1 year of him producing at a high level. What I do like, and I mean, this was just, of course, the byproduct of COVID. I like with McCarthy that he's kind of that old school, and I'm using air quotes here, that old school prospect that, like, when I first got into scouting, like 2013, 2014, where he played a lot early, showed at like 18 and 19 years old that, yeah, he can play and play at a high level in a Power 5 conference at a big time school. And by the time he was 20, 21, he was like, I'm going to the NFL draft. Like, if you look back at even pre-COVID, to see the 20, 21-year-olds, that's usually the first round. To see, like, even a 22-year-old turning 23, like a fifth-year senior, was like, whoa, this guy's kind of old. And now this year, it was like, oh, everyone's 24 and 25, and it's weird. So to me, like, in watching him and poring over the analytics, factoring in his age, I was like, yeah, if this was pre-COVID, I think would look at him differently and say he was able to do this when Michael Penix was like getting hurt at Indiana, or Bo Nix was not draftable at Auburn. And that was always something, not even just with wide receivers, but with quarterbacks as well. And you made a point during this entire draft process, which I think is a good one, that, you know, maybe, and I think you got it maybe from Kwesi or from KOC, that like teams maybe at quarterback like that these guys are older because, you know, Bo Nix started 60 games, like the experience side. And I think that does matter. But again, starting almost 30 games and the magnitude of many of those games that he played in, I think certainly matters. And is, to me, as someone that really has always tried to factor in age a little bit, is the perfect blend of fair amount of experience, big game experience, production in key moments, and you just don't know what he's going to become and how high his potential is, because again, Bo Nix was kind of waffling at Oregon at this point, and we didn't certainly think of Michael Penix as a potential top 10 overall pick. JJ McCarthy will now be getting NFL coaching and throwing the football to Justin Jefferson.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I probably throughout the process said a few times, if he had stayed in college for even one or two more years, and if he went to a school that played the spread offense and threw it all over the place, what would those numbers look like? And yeah, that's really the bet that the Vikings are making, is that he would continue to progress. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. He is clearly going to have to do that a ton, because that the thing with Penix for me, why I liked Penix as a fit for the Vikings the entire time, it was just so easy to see it. So easy to take him, what you saw at Washington, and go, boop, here's what he would look like in the NFL, because he's throwing 40 passes a game, which the quarterback of the Minnesota Vikings is going to have to do. If you think that KOC is suddenly going to switch to being Jim Harbaugh, I got news for you. He's not. You better be ready to throw and throw and throw and throw. And look, they put everything on Kirk Cousins over the last few years. Kirk Cousins was also 34 and 35 years old and had been doing this for a very long time. So, you know, we saw all the development that Kirk Cousins made even within the system, and how long it took him, where it took him a year and a half to be fully comfortable with everything that Kevin O'Connell wanted him to do. And that's just the point about this development process. And they're going to have to believe that McCarthy can get there to that point within the next 2 years, to where they're going to expect to be highly competitive. Last thing on McCarthy from you, Chris, is what if it works? What if it doesn't? What will have happened if it works? What will have happened if it doesn't with JJ McCarthy?
If it works, I think maybe he doesn't start week one, but I'm really not someone, and I don't think you are either, but someone that is like, hey, you draft a guy and we're talking about how young he is. And that, I think all of your points certainly make sense about it. This is a complex system, and even someone like Kirk Cousins took time to really get acclimated and fully comfortable. But I'm not someone that's like, hey, you draft a quarterback in the first round, sit him for a year, 2 years. Like, that doesn't happen. And I think, I don't want to say throw him into the fire, but just especially in such a, what I think is an insulated environment in Minnesota, let him start by week four, week six, week eight, somewhere in that range where you're probably not, you know, 0-4, 0-6, but you're kind of, hey, maybe we're 3-3 and we kind of need a couple wins, or we need a spark. If it works out, I think you will see maybe at the start a little bit of more low volume passing, or maybe more schemed open throws, that more so than what KOC wants, that just gives JJ McCarthy that confidence to say, all right, look, you can do this. You can show, or you can handle more on your plate than what Jim Harbaugh gave you at Michigan. Look at the talent that we have here in Minnesota. And then ultimately and gradually increase it from there. If it doesn't work, I think it's kind of obvious. It would maybe just be that JJ McCarthy is best when he doesn't have a lot on his plate, and there's only, hey, can you make like two good throws a game if we need it? Otherwise, we're just going to run the ball and it's just going to be really off you. It's going to be everything, screens, RPOs. We're not going to ask any of that from you. But I really am leaning toward that. I think it will work because of his makeup, the, to me, underrated traits. And like we're mentioning, he's young, and the upside, certainly gives him kind of an incomplete grade because we didn't see it like we saw it with Penix, like you're mentioning, like kind of the pro style offense. It's kind of funny that like Jim Harbaugh 5 years ago or 10 years ago would have had a pro style offense, but now we're like, no, dude, that's not pro style. Like Michael Penix and what Bo Nix did, that was more pro style. today that I think that's what ultimately could be, you know, somewhat of a downfall for him. But I am leaning toward it ultimately working because there's so much untapped potential. And I think this coaching staff, this situation will get the most out of JJ McCarthy.
I would like to see, as far as adjustments go, it's funny because we talked about Jaden Daniels as someone that, well, they'd have to overhaul if they ended up with him. I think that there's a bit of an overhaul that has to be done here, whether it's McCarthy this year or McCarthy 8 weeks in or McCarthy deep into the future. And one of those things is to have him on the move, running a lot of bootlegs, running a lot of play action where he was very comfortable under center, doing those things that make life easier on the quarterback. That was a huge Gary Kubiak thing, a huge Sean McVay thing early on in Jared Goff's career. But with Kirk Cousins, there was a lot of straight drop back. It was shotgun, straight drop back every once in a while. But Kirk was actually phenomenal at running the boots, and they just did not do that stuff as much. I think part of that was because of at some point, if they ran the defensive end upfield, Kirk couldn't run away from the guy. Mm-hmm. So McCarthy can run away from the guy. If they do that, that might help them feel more confident in running those play actions. But you're going to have to lean into the things, motions, play actions, quick passing game, screens to your running back, all those things that they didn't do well to help out Kirk Cousins over the last few years under Kevin O'Connell that a lot of teams do use. I look at Zach Taylor and Jake Browning as the definition of how you set up life to be easy for your quarterback. To get that out of Jake Browning, who throws the ball probably as softly as anyone in the entire NFL over the last 5 years, was really impressive. And I think that there's lessons there that you could take away from that. And if it doesn't work, there'll be two things that happen. One is they push too hard to rely on all the other stuff, the straight drop back, put too much on his plate, and he starts to lose confidence or doesn't react quickly enough. The other thing is too, that have you ever seen anybody throw a spear? You ever see what that looks like? It just goes straight, right on a line. You can't put touch on a spear. He throws spears. Like, he just throws it freaking fast, as hard as he can, rockets. And if you do that in the NFL, the linebacker will catch it. That's correct. UNLV's linebacker is not. Well, the other thing too is that Fred Warner's arms are twice the size of my arms. They're going to knock those down. They're going to make plays on the ball. You cannot whip it 10 feet off the ground through NFL players. He actually had a fairly high turnover worthy play rate compared to the rest of the guys in this draft class. And if he does not learn to throw the football with touch on it, he's going to throw a lot of interceptions if he's doing it that way. And that could be a difficult part of it, even if all the other parts of his game are good.
Yeah. And one point that you mentioned early there, that it's funny that when you're mentioning that, hey, like, maybe they'll start to use the boot action and so much play action, that to me, that's like the staple of the Shanahan system that Kevin O'Connell is running. But then you to point out that they didn't really do that a lot with Kirk. It kind of feels like that's like the last, or actually maybe it's like the first part of the playbook that they just kind of skipped over with Kirk. They're like, look, you're 34, you're good at it, but we don't really want to put you in that situation too often. That's going to be what they're going to install instantly, because at Michigan, that's what they certainly did a lot as well. And he has the athleticism to do that. So to me, that's why I, you know, partially love this fit, because he feels like someone that, I mean, he did it at Michigan, but is the ideal quarterback to run a lot of those plays and throws where he's on the move. He's very comfortable doing that. He's a natural thrower. He's not awkward throwing on the run. And I think made some of his best throws at Michigan, not even outside of structure within the play structure, but just rolling near the sideline, rolling right, rolling left. So that will just kind of be like, I think for Kevin O'Connell, be like, we can get back to like the basics of the Shanahan system, like stretch run to the right, stretch run to the left. All right, third down, bootleg, and there's a wide open TJ Hockenson or Justin Jefferson. And maybe it will have to be a 20 or a 30 yard throw, but now we have a quarterback that maybe has a little more miles per hour on the pass with JJ McCarthy.
It's funny about athleticism and how it works, right? Somebody was talking about this the other night during the Denver game and Jokic, and just how he's not an impressive athlete necessarily, but yet all these twitch things that he does, the smoothness of what he's able to do is athleticism. And McCarthy has some of that. I think McCarthy was a great hockey player, but I bet he's good at everything. I bet he's a good golfer. I bet he's a good baseball player. Like he's got that to him. The pass that was thrown inaccurately back to him that he caught really stood out to me. Yeah. Was that against Alabama? Like
how Alabama in the Rose Bowl.
Right. Yeah. That's a very athletic play. Weirdly, Kirk was a bad athlete in comparison to guys for speed, size, those types of things, but was a good basketball player growing up, all those things. And the one thing he always had going for him was those throws on the move. And it's a bit of a cheat code if you could do those and add a running element to it, which of course Kirk didn't have, McCarthy does. So anyway, that's 20 minutes of why McCarthy needs the boots. And we'll see if Kevin O'Connell can apply those. But also, you know, hey, Sam Darnold needs him too, you know, how he played last year. Let's go to, and we're going to go pick by pick here and break down every pick. And we'll see if by the last seventh rounder, you had heard of the guy before, because a lot of people had not. Dallas Turner. If the Vikings hadn't been drafting a quarterback and drafted Dallas Turner, we would have said, what an ideal outcome for them to get their edge rusher. The discussion has been a lot more about the price than the player. So give me your breakdown of, was it worth it? And then what the Vikings are getting in Dallas Turner.
I think it was worth it. I mean, in the draft trade chart that I use, it was a slight overpayment. It was 260 to 268. I think I tweeted that right after the trade. So not like an egregious, like, what the hell? Why did they give that extra pick? But a little bit of an overpayment, which is fine, I think, when you're getting a premier position. If they were doing this for run-stopping nose tackle or an in-the-box safety, you'd kind of be like, what are you doing here? But, yeah, I think Dallas Turner, it's kind of funny that both of the first-round picks are 21 years old, like high upside. We don't really know what they're going to be. It's not Laiatu Latu. It's not Michael Penix, where they're like finished products. They played an insane amount of football. They're 23. They're Senior Bowl guys. With Dallas Turner, it's the final year at Alabama, the lights came on. And I think I wrote that about 50 times about Dallas Turner during the pre-draft process, that I remember watching Alabama games over the last couple of years. And it was about, hey, Will Anderson is this, you know, number one recruit, amazing player. And then, oh yeah, the next guy in line is Dallas Turner. He was the number one edge rusher. And I didn't really see it early on. Like Will Anderson in his first season at Alabama as a freshman was like, whoa, this guy's going to be a top 10 pick eventually. He ultimately goes number 3. Dallas Turner, it was like, okay, I can see why he was a big-time recruit. He was the best edge rusher in the nation. But I didn't see that. I didn't see him hit the ground running as a freshman or a sophomore. This past season, the pressure creation rate went through the roof. And you saw more bend. What I'm a huge fan of, you saw more pass rush moves. And I think early on, Dallas Turner was like, I'm the best athlete out here. I can bend. I can get off the ball faster than anyone. And then he was like, oh, in the SEC, maybe I'm not going to be so good at doing that just as my only way to beat blockers. This year, there was a swim move, a swipe move, counter moves where he would try a bull rush. Oh, it's not working. Let's rip to the inside. Let's just fake the outside speed rush, cross over like a basketball player. So I always referred to him as someone that he's finally saw the lights come on, and as an ascending rusher, because he's so young and the one final year elite production. We've talked so much about the impact of Brian Flores and Jonathan Grenard and Van Ginkle that they brought in to add another like specimen at the edge rusher spot that can move around and has ridiculous length. I think that was a Brian Flores pick, and one that Kwesi and KOC are probably like, look, if anyone's going to get the most out of Dallas Turner in these next couple years, those cheap rookie deal years, it's probably Brian Flores. And so I don't think Dallas Turner is a finished product. I had him as my edge 3. I didn't think he was like, you know, ready to come in, be an 80 pressure guy right away. But I do think because of his length, and that what he showed and how productive he was in 2023 at Alabama, very good signs for his future in the NFL.
Folks, we all have smartphones and we know that they are pretty amazing, but they can also be amazingly distracting, especially when we're around other people. So US Cellular wants us to reset our relationship with our phones by putting down our phones for five. That's right, a company that sells phones wants us to put down our phones and see what we can find. Learn more at uscellular.com/builtforus. That's uscellular.com/builtforus.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It's a great point to bring up the surplus value for an edge rusher as part of the equation for trading up. I think it's very important. If you were to sign, even let's say he doesn't become Miles Garrett, let's say he just becomes good. What does that cost you? Well, Jonathan Grenard gives us a pretty good idea of that. Jonathan Grenard is good, but he's not Miles Garrett. That was what, $22 million a year, $20 million a year.
Expensive.
Well, that's at least $10 to $15 million per year during his entire rookie contract that you get as surplus value between what a good player would cost. And then if he becomes great, then you're talking about $25 million or something like that. Of that, it's one of the most, it's the second most expensive position. Maybe wide receiver is catching up, but those two positions are the highest paid in the NFL outside of quarterback, receiver, and edge rusher. So that's where, all right, I'll give up an extra late pick to get someone with the potential of being great. And I also think that they probably looked at the board and said, we've got our great tier, we've got our good tier, we've got our maybe tier, and there's only one guy left in the great tier. So let's trade up and make sure we get him the way that he fits in the defense. It feels like it, what is it? The rug ties together the room in the Big Lebowski. It's like it ties together the room. It didn't quite make sense, this defense, until Dallas Turner arrived. And his expectation for year one should be someone who develops and comes along and they can rush him situationally, play Van Ginkle in different spots. So he doesn't have to take on everything right away. But the fact that he's versatile too, drop back in coverage, he's on the lighter side. So I think Flores can use that as more of the 3-4 outside linebacker, like that's where his roots are. And we've seen so many guys like that in the Patriots style defensive system. Jamie Collins couldn't succeed anywhere else except for New England. So we've seen this player have a lot of success. That's why, to me, I thought this was a great pick. And then I go to Twitter and everyone's saying it's a bad pick. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm missing here, but I guess I don't put as much stock into draft value charts as maybe other people do.
Oh yeah. I mean, if it was like egregious, if it was 260 points to 310, then you'd be like, they just gave away an extra pick. Like they just were wrong on that. So to be 8 points off is not crazy. But everything that you said about surplus value with the edge rusher spot certainly makes a ton of sense. And what I'll say too is, and you mentioning Van Ginkle kind of sparked this in my head, that Van Ginkle was so like, he got to be so annoying for offenses in Miami like the last couple of years, but he's not just like your normal three down defensive end. And so I think to draft Dallas Turner, it's one of two things: that they're like, you are going to be our other defensive end opposite Jonathan Grenard, or Brian Flores was like convincing Kwesi of saying, I want two of these guys that can be A gap blitzers that are going to line up as that old school 3-4 outside linebacker. They can put their hand in the dirt and like, we can show offensive line, the entire line, not just tackles, like different looks, like every single down. If we want to have someone, okay, he's going to be rushing from the right defensive end, every single snap, like that can make it a little easier on an offense, on a quarterback with sliding protections, things like that. Dallas Turner and Van Ginkle, I'm not going to say that like they're the same player, but they're similar stylistically in terms of how you can utilize them. So that I really liked about it. And one last thing. So I have, and I'll be very short on this. I created which you know about this, but I don't think any listeners do. I created a draft model over the last couple of years It's not perfect. There's certainly misses. It is called RESIN. It stands for Reverse Engineered Scouting Index Number. It just popped into my head. That's what it's called. Dallas Turner had the highest edge rusher RESIN in this class, slightly ahead of Laiatu and Chop Robinson. I didn't go with Turner as my number one edge. I have factored it into my grades, but I like when they're so close, I kind of just let my own observations kind of pick who's one, two, three. But this is like a model that is like, you know, predicted Max Crosby to be really good. He had the third highest RESIN in 2019. And even if it's not like totally flawless to find a fifth rounder who ends up being good, what I love about it is beyond that, it validates the really good prospects. Like there are very few guys that go early that have a very high RESIN score. Like Nick Bosa's was high. Josh Allen of the Jaguars was very high. Micah Parsons was absolutely through the roof. So with Dallas Turner, even having him as my edge three, I think I had him in my top 15 or 18. He feels like someone that I saw it on film. And then even maybe more importantly than that, the model that I created that, you know, factors in on-field stuff, athleticism, like a lot of different things, also said like based on from 2018 until 2023, which is the data set that I have, like it validated that, yeah, if he goes early, he's going to probably be a pretty good player because he, again, the production is there. The athleticism is there. You just can check a lot of those boxes from film and on the analytics side.
So you're giving that an A? Everybody wants to know the letter grade.
A. Okay, okay. Let's give it an A.
All right. It's an A for me. I never thought they'd get him. I thought he would be gone.
He was sticking out. It kind of was like, because forever, everyone, including myself, was like, Dallas Turner to the Falcons at 8, like every mock draft. I think my last one, I was like, I have to change this up because this is just ridiculous. And then at 17, he's still on the board where everyone's like, he's going to be the first defensive player picked. He was kind of sticking out like a sore thumb. So I think to your point, the Vikings were probably like, this one guy in the great category, like, let's go and get him. He's playing a premier position. Our defensive coordinator loves him. Like, it was kind of a no-brainer, I think, at that point for the Vikings.
All right. So then we sat around
for a while
and sat around. It was the most boring Friday night of the draft I've ever had in my life. I watched basketball and did nothing. And then we motored it up again on Saturday, revved it up right at the beginning of the fourth round when the Vikings selected Kyree Jackson, a guy with a super interesting background, quit football out of high school, went to community college, got a year knocked off from COVID where his team didn't play, then goes to Bama, doesn't get much of a chance, didn't maybe get along with Nick Saban the best, goes out to Oregon, finds himself, plays incredibly well by the numbers, just a terrific player last season, and then lands himself here. Unique guy at almost 6'4". What is your take on where Kyree Jackson might fit in and your thoughts on him as a prospect?
This is very similar to the book on Xavien Howard when he was coming out of Baylor. And again, I think there's more of the Brian Flores footprint that we talk about Flores a lot, but it feels like nationally or just on Twitter, it's always like KOC, Josh McCown, offense. It's like, you also have Brian Flores here, who is a former head coach and is one of the more respected defensive minds in the league that schemes it up as well as any younger defensive coordinator in football. And of course, in Miami, he was integral in Xavien Howard becoming that elite, like, ball hawk that he was with the Dolphins. And when he was coming out of Baylor, he was really tall, like almost absurdly tall, very athletic, just like Kyree Jackson. And there were times where he looked like he did not know what was going on in coverage. Then there were times where he was suffocating at the line and the best receivers in college football in the Big 12 then could not get past him at the line. And if they decided to even try to throw in his target area, it was either going to be a pass breakup or a pick. And I remember, I think 2015 class, 2016, it was like, he's either going to boom or be out of the league in a couple years. That's kind of how I feel about Kyree Jackson, that I remember watching it and I'm like, this is Xavien Howard. I believe I comped him to Xavien Howard in our little spreadsheet that we had that went on the site for CBS. And then when they picked him, I was like, oh my God, like that makes so much sense. Why didn't I think of that earlier? That great at the line of scrimmage, pretty much everything I just mentioned about Xavien Howard. I wrote that there were inconsistencies in coverage and that quicker separators will lose him. But because of his speed and certainly the length that he has, he can get his hands on the football when he's not right in the hip pocket of the wide receivers. I love his press technique. It could get a little better. He's often maybe a little too aggressive at the line, but you feel like Brian Flores can probably really hone in on this skill that's there and just his natural assertive nature. He's a good tackler, which I think is really important. And he wasn't thrown at a lot, but the ball production was certainly there. And that's huge for me. We've talked about it, that it kind of seems like box score scouting, but I'm like, if you're a corner and you have like, oh, you had no pass breakups and no picks in college, but you're great. It's like, you're probably not great then. But if you have a bunch of them and, you know, relative to how many targets you saw, then that's usually a good sign. So it just felt like Kyree Jackson was Xavien Howard 2.0 in the eyes of Brian Flores. And I believe just for the grade, I'll look right here, he was in my top 60. So to get him in the fourth round, I thought with the size, the length, the athleticism, and maybe some inconsistencies, but the high highs, I thought it certainly made a lot of sense for a defense that I think kind of desperately needed that big time talent at the cornerback spot.
And also, you know, Brian Flores has made it very clear that he agrees with you and I when it comes to playing the football. Mekhi Blackmon last year had the same kind of profile. Yep. And that one is, all of my draft opinions are just common sense based on covering NFL games. And a lot of times the best corners are the ones that make plays on the football. And if you don't make plays on the football with these receivers in the NFL, you're telling me that it's going to go okay. Just think about the T. Higgins play down the sideline over a Caleb Evans last year. Yep. It's like making plays on the ball is just so huge. And by the numbers with Kyree Jackson, one out of every four throws that went his way either got picked off or batted down.
That's
a remarkable rate, right?
It's insane. That's how Xavien Howard was at Baylor, truly.
And there's something that you're willing to give up if somebody can make plays on the ball, kind of the Trayvon Diggs thing, where they wanted, and they even talked about this as an emphasis, to make more interceptions with the corners. I don't remember how many they had. It was very few from the corners. A lot of times it was the safeties making plays, Harrison Smith, Josh Metellus, Cam Bynum, but not so much the corners. They went looking for that with Kyree Jackson. Walter Rouse, you put us in a room with Walter Rouse. Let me tell you,
he's huge.
He's going to be bigger and smarter and more successful than both of us by a lot. He can jump higher than us. His arm length is twice the size of we are. This guy is really something. He comes from a bloodline of athletes, but also went for a biochemical engineering major at Stanford. And because he was committed, because he was committed to football and wants to do the other stuff after football, he said, let me go to Oklahoma, sort of known as offensive line U. Their offensive line coach there is very good, gets a lot of guys drafted.
Oh, yeah.
And so he decided to go there, had a flat out terrific season at Oklahoma. And I think his age played a role in it. And I also wonder sometimes about this myself, is guys who go to Stanford, Princeton, whatever, how long is he going to stick around in the NFL? Is he going to want to decide eventually, I'm going to go
to something
else?
Is he a football guy?
Yeah, that's right. You got to wonder if it's somebody, because this is next level. I mean, this is pastronaut level, difficult stuff, the same as Josh Dobbs for an offensive tackle. But he showed his commitment to it, and I think they got someone who in the sixth round gives them a chance to have a rotational tackle right away. But what did you think of Walter Rouse?
So I just had it up what I gave it. I gave it a B live. I thought at his size with over 35 inch arms, which that is, offensive line coach is going to be happy when you have 35 inch arms. Like, that's insane. 6'5", 313 pounds. He has a frame that can add more weight to it. And to me, and I wrote this on the CBS Sports Draft Tracker, there's usually not, it's like you mentioning Oklahoma is like offensive lineman U, like they do send so many to the NFL up front. I almost always write for them scouting report wise over the years that he is a classic Oklahoma blocker. And what is that? That is huge, powerful, clunky feet, not an insane athlete. Think Orlando Brown. I mean, he's obviously not as big as Orlando Brown, but that's the kind of player that he was. And what I do like about him is that, even though maybe some of the athletic limitations, you know, against those super speedy outside rushers, he'll get kind of stretched beyond his athletic limit. he was better in pass protection than as a run blocker. A lot of the Oklahoma blockers who don't pan out, like here in Buffalo, Cody Ford, the Bills traded up to get him in the second round, 2019, he could like pave the lanes for the run, but as a pass blocker, his balance was off. He wasn't aware of stunts, twists, blitzes, kind of really surprised him, got him off balance easily. His anchor wasn't good. With Rouse, you get someone that is NFL ready as a pass blocker. So I think, like you mentioned, sixth round, you know, to be your backup to Brian O'Neill or to maybe eventually be like that very valuable swing tackle that we always hear about, that I think every team wants to have a very good one. I thought it was a smart pick. I'm just a little concerned, again, because he's that kind of that classic Oklahoma blocker, that he's not crazy athletic, but the power, the balance in pass protection, and he's just one of the more calmer players or blockers in pass protection, that he's aware of where he needs to be. So I think he was well coached at Oklahoma, like you mentioned.
Well, and Ryan Grigson brought up something that was smart after the draft about Walter Rouse, and I think he talked about it with Michael Juergens as well, that with a 17-game season, backup offensive linemen are going to play.
Like, your quality, important.
Right. Your quality of backup offensive linemen, we usually look for rosters at just the starters and go, all right, there's the team. Well, receivers might play 17. Corners get banged up a lot. You need a lot of them. Offensive linemen get banged up a lot. You're going to need a lot of them. And getting a swing tackle, they have David Questenberry. He's on the older side, kind of a bounce around type of veteran. Having a swing guy could matter if O'Neill gets hurt, if Darrisaw gets hurt. That offensive line depth, when you're picking in the sixth round, that's something that's worth going after. Totally. Because you're probably not looking at who's going to be our future starter at whatever position. You're saying, how can we stack up some of these positions? That I really like how one time Greg Rosenthal, NFL.com, said he thought in order to win a Super Bowl, you have to have 40 good players, good or above. And I was like, 40, man, that's like twice a team. But then as I went through it, when the Vikings have been good, they had about that many. They were at least two deep or three deep at certain positions. So if Walter Rouse can be a swing tackle and is effective, then it's a home run pick for them. Here's the, I want to say, most controversial, and I use that very lightly, of day three for the Vikings, Will Reichard. I don't know if you scout kickers or if you have opinions on kickers or how someone scouts kickers beyond just looking at their percentage.
So I mean, that's a great question. Those are great questions. I usually don't scout kickers because I think it is a little silly to do it beyond just how many field goals did they make relative to how many did they kick. Now, certainly in NFL teams, they have guys that are scouting like their form and how strong their leg is. But what I like about him is that he's like the opposite of Roberto Aguayo, who went in the second round however many years ago. Like, I think, didn't Tampa Bay trade up to pick him? And he was this decorated kicking recruit, and each year at Florida State, his make percentage went down. Reichard's the opposite. He went up every year. Like, he was decorated. Like, Alabama gets the five-star kickers, too, during the Nick Saban era. And it was like, I don't know the exact numbers, but it was like 76, 79, 83. Like, it went up every year. So he is Dallas Turner, ascending rusher. This is an ascending field goal kicker. So I think you mentioned to me pre-draft that you wouldn't be shocked if they pick a kicker, right? And so to get someone I don't remember.
Did we talk?
Did you say that or punt? I don't know if you said that or punter.
I said punter, I wanted him to draft.
Yes. Punter. Okay, my bad.
I wanted him to draft the guy from Iowa. Yes, but Chicago got him.
You're right. Okay. That if you're going to pick one, I used to like always give these like an F grade. Like, I was like, why are you picking? But I realize teams, you know, sixth, seventh round, like you probably do need to pick one in that range to get like the best in the class. Like, they're not just all going undrafted. So is it my favorite allocation of a Vikings pick? No, but I do like the pedigree, kicking at Alabama, and the fact, of course, that he just made a higher percentage of kicks in all of his 3 years at Alabama.
We can't just say, if it works out, it'll look good for them for every pick, because you could do that for every team all the time. At some point, we do have to break down the logic behind it. The history behind drafting kickers is not particularly great. It's not particularly great for the Minnesota Vikings. The last two guys they picked like this were Blair Walsh and Daniel Carlson. Carlson became a great kicker for someone else. Blair Walsh, we know what happened with Blair Walsh. It always makes me think that when you draft the guy, you're too in love with him. It's harder to objectively analyze him versus other kickers. And the sample size is still coming out of college. We're only talking about kind of a handful of kicks per year in college. And there's something different. I don't know if it's because things get sped up in the NFL. I really don't, or if the pressure is different, but there is something different between kicking in the NFL and college. And he made 84% in college. If he makes 84% in the NFL, you are the most meh kind of kicker. You're Greg Joseph. You're just kind of a guy. So there is an adjustment there. I would prefer the asset go somewhere else. They seem to really love him. And what's different is that he's got an extra year to analyze what he could do. I still am just kind of like, I don't know, man, a kicker.
But yeah, yes, it's definitely, great, I mean, yeah, like when the Bills picked Tyler Bass in the fifth or sixth round in 2019 or 2020, I was kind of like, oh, you could have picked a running back. You could have picked a swing tackle offensive lineman. So like you're saying, like if it turns out, if he, you know, can improve, then sure, that's great. But in a vacuum, I mean, we have to be fair and objective with our analysis here that it probably was not the best allocation, even of a sixth round pick.
Yeah, I think that there's always levels of disagreement that I want to have. I like to do a meter on the show. Is it like a yellow? Is it an orange? Is it a red? This is a yellow. Like, I'm not going to lose my mind. I don't know if it's the best way to go about it, but I'm not going to freak out. Michael Juergens. What do we know about Michael Juergens?
All right. This is the bummer part of the episode. So the last two picks I did not watch. I did not watch pre-draft. I watched 285 prospects. I am texting scouts and other draft analysts like, hey, like, and this is pretty much all April. Like, is there any other players that you think I should watch? And there were a bunch. Like, there was only maybe 5 to 10 picks that it was probably closer to 10 to 12 that I just did not watch. Two of them were Vikings. And I instantly, the second that those picks went in, instantly thought of this podcast, thought of you, thought of all these awesome listeners and viewers, and was like, crap. But I mean, if you want to talk to me about them, that's fine. The undrafted free agent class, I do think we need to talk about to end the show. Like, before we go into more general draft stuff, which we can do as well, because there were some that I watched that didn't get drafted that the Vikings scooped up that I really liked.
If you don't have a blazing take on the seventh rounders,
I don't. I wish I did. I love to have it normally.
You're trying to cover the entire league and you missed from Texas A&M Commerce, which I had never heard of as a college, much less a player, Levi Drake Rodriguez and Michael Juergens. All I can say really about either one of these guys is right position. Yeah. They needed interior offensive line depth. They need defensive tackles who have some pedigree of rushing the passer. And Rodriguez is intriguing because he's the right size. Normally, if you draft one of these guys, you're talking about a Hercules Mata'afa and you're going, maybe you could be John Randall. And you're like, no, he's not going to be John Randall. This is not like that. This guy is 6'4" and 290 pounds and really was late coming on because he was, first of all, never thinking he'd be a pro athlete, but was playing baseball and football at the same time, decides to kind of put the pedal to the metal and is a late bloomer who dominated at his level. And that's the best you can do. I don't have any more questions, but from the UDFA perspective, you and I spent maybe 5 minutes talking about Gabriel Murphy because I think I drafted him in like the fourth round. And I thought
everyone thought he was going to go there.
Versatility, production, all looked great. There you go. Good fit for the Minnesota Vikings. Falls all the way off the draft board. Tell me if there's any explanation. And also, is this the next guy that Kwesi Adofo-Mensah steals in the UDFA market?
Yes, I think so. And I think, I mean, we could, I mean, we're not going to do it, but we could have another episode on what the Vikings have done. I don't want to say like they're just copying what PFF thinks about these players, but like last year, like PFF loved Ivan Pace Jr. I know your intern did as well. They get him. Like, didn't Andre Carter make the team too?
He did. Yep. He did.
So Andre Carter, you know, had tons of production at Army. Gabriel Murphy, to answer your question, PFF liked him. I liked him a lot too. My model liked him. He was the number 7 edge rusher in my model. Tested really well, was super productive. He's a little older and he has really short arms. So that's like maybe those last two things, because he's a little on the smaller side. He's actually right around the same size as Dallas Turner. He just is like literally has like 10 inch shorter arms than him. Like they're not on the same, stratosphere in terms of length, but in terms of being, and anyone could go back to listen to that episode, he's super slippery. Whoever the defensive line coach was at UCLA taught he, his brother, and Laiatu Latu like 50 different pass rush moves, and they were so comfortable with them, they used like almost all of them every single game. Like he was one of the slipperiest pass rushers in this class. He kind of feels like the Ivan Pace Jr., where we could look back next or in 9 months and go, yeah, he fell off or totally off the draft board because of some physical limitations, but he's just a really good football player. And it kind of harkens back to the point that I made earlier about Dallas Turner and Andrew Van Ginkel and moving him around. Like with Gabriel Murphy, that's what you're going to do. You're not going to say you're going to put your hand in the dirt and try to set the edge. It's going to be, you're going to see rushes from him against centers on a blitz where he can use a swim move or a swipe move or just his athleticism to win. And then on the next snap, he's dropping into coverage. The next snap, he's over the left guard. That is certainly, I don't want to say that they zeroed in on that type because he was an undrafted free agent, but it's not surprising that they brought him in because the production, the athleticism is there, and he's that movable chess piece.
The philosophy that Brian Flores has, as he has explained it to us, is always looking for what a guy can do. So if he can do one thing exceptionally well,
just do that. Yeah, just tap into that.
Right. Brian Flores is interested, and he's going to try to work that into the defense. There were games last year where 19 guys hit the field on defense. Wow. I mean, under the Mike Zimmer era, they were playing the starters and mixing in Brian Robinson, and that was it. And with this, he was rotating in. You didn't even know who was going to be on the field at what time, trying to find the right fits to maximize the things people could do. And under normal circumstances, I would probably just shrug my shoulders, but they proved to me last year, all right, I guess we do have to watch these UDFAs. Give me one or two other UDFAs that caught your eye.
Dwight McGlothern from Arkansas. And I mean, for as much as I respect PFF, being an analyst myself, I don't usually like cite their grades, just a totally different process. But everything that they do with their analytics, like their advanced stats, I think is absolutely invaluable. Like you need to be looking at those if you want to be as good of an analyst as possible. But I will in this episode, and to answer this question, kind of go against that and say, I believe he had the highest coverage grade of any corner in PFF. Did you check this? Did you see this yet?
No, did not. Maybe not. I did not.
Okay. I believe.
Can I say something?
I don't know if it was. Yeah, go ahead.
If the thing about those grades is if somebody has a grade like that and you're talking about a UDFA, just do it. Like, just do it. Like,
exactly. That's what I'm saying.
There's
yes.
Something there, right?
And that's why I think that Kwesi and, you know, that he's got the analytics mind and that he's running the show. And then certainly I'm sure like the coaches are involved in the UDFA process too, but Kwesi could probably very quickly and in a very articulate way convince a cornerbacks coach, like, look at this, like, look at his grades. He had 21 pass breakups, 8 interceptions at LSU and Arkansas. And what's ironic, if you want to just like very quickly get an idea of Dwight, of this player, watch the LSU game. Watch him against Malik Nabers and Brian Thomas. He has an interception of Jaden Daniels, one of only 4 interceptions from Jaden Daniels last season. Now, he is like weirdly shaped. He's like 6'2", but under 200 pounds. Has very short arms. Didn't test particularly well. Ran kind of slow. But the zone instincts, and for someone that is not crazy fast, there were a lot of reps in that game, literally against Malik Nabers, who according to the LSU Pro Day ran like 4.3 with a 42-inch vertical, where Dwight is right in his hip pocket down the field in the end zone. So to get someone like that, like you're saying, like maybe the rest of the NFL is like, hey, this guy's not worth it. He's just not a great athlete. But starting at LSU and then playing very well at Arkansas, I think after the draft, it's certainly worth rolling the dice on. Again, particularly for a team that needs some more talent at the cornerback spot.
Anybody else? Because I have some rapid fire, big picture.
Sure. Yeah, I'll just be super quick. Bo Richter of Air Force. He does not have any pass rush moves whatsoever, but he was very productive and his RAS was like 9 point something. So I think right there you just say, hey, look, like, let's see you just get around the corner and bend. And I did watch him. I graded him. So I think he's someone that's just worth that flyer because of the athleticism and that in college, he was able to get to the quarterback and generate pressure at a pretty good rate.
There you have it. They also picked up like 8 linebackers. So we'll watch if any of those guys become special teamers and the next backup linebackers. But overall, without a ton of draft picks, it's hard to go crazy about anything in the late rounds. But I think they did fine for themselves of getting a few spots that they need. I would have liked to see a running back just to throw another body in that group, maybe even a wide receiver. Let me go through some things just big picture NFL wise with you that happened on draft night that will have long-term implications. The first obvious, now we could spend a lot of time on this. So how about give me your, this is like your play clock. You got to get the call in to the quarterback. That's how you should treat these rapid fires. Michael Penix to the Atlanta Falcons reaction.
Just my overall thoughts on the pick or like what it says about the NFL.
What did you think about it?
I was very surprised at the Falcons process. That was the first thing that came to my head. And I had him graded, I think at 28 or 29. That's maybe a little bit more of a reach than I'm willing to give teams at the quarterback spot. There's usually more leeway there. But I was just like, what? They just signed Kirk Cousins, $100 million fully guaranteed. I know he's older, coming off an Achilles. It was just way more about the process than anything else with me that was just very confusing for a team that was like, you could probably win the NFC South and you have the 8th overall pick. You need so many pieces on defense. Your offensive line is not amazing. This is a great offensive tackle class. There's 4 really good edge rushers. There's some great corners. And they pick a 24-year-old and say, hey, if we don't play him in 5 years, that means Kirk's been really good. It's like, well, that would be kind of a waste of a pick then, picking him at 8 overall. So that was my overall, just my instant reaction thought to Penix going 8 to the Falcons.
I'll give you my real quick 30-second spiel on this. In order to pick a quarterback, Terry Fontenot, their GM, had to stand in a room and tell everybody, including their owner, that this was going to be their plan. And in order to sell that to everybody, because GMs, people seem to think that GMs just make all the decisions and don't ask anybody. I don't know. Howie Roseman just does this. Like, that's a whole organization that's working on these things. I don't know. Spend some time covering a team. But the way that this would have to work is he would have to pitch this idea to the owner, to other people in the front office, to the coaching staff, and everyone would have to say, or at least the majority, the people who matter, would have to say, all right, then we're on board with drafting Michael Penix and therefore sacrificing, potentially picking Laiatu Latu or whatever other player they could have taken. Why? Why was everyone convinced this is a good idea? Is it because they don't believe that Kirk's going to be around all that long with his health? They are concerned about that. I mean, I don't know, but there has to be a reason. It wasn't just someone going rogue and picking his friend or whatever. It was like, there has to be a reason. And clearly they're not going to tell everyone the reason. I want to know the reason, and maybe it will present itself at some point down the road. I want to give them the credit to say, when somebody does something totally nuts, that isn't Washington, who's just nuts, or what, you know, a team that a Cleveland, this is nuts. We should say, is there some that they know here that maybe?
Yes, I think that's a good, Yeah. Like, I think whenever something unprecedented happens, it's easy. And I mean, I guess I kind of just did it there. Like, I didn't understand the process, but it's easy for everyone to just jump on and laugh and say, hey, that's unconventional. But a lot of like the best ideas come from unconventional origins. So if you want to look at it that way, I don't think it's crazy. I just don't get the giving Kirk the money and then picking a quarterback inside the top 8. But we talked about Dallas Turner and like, hey, the positional surplus or the financial surplus that you get from just picking an edge rusher in the first round. You certainly get that at the quarterback spot too.
Yeah, it just goes to the, and trust me, I was as shocked as anybody who watched the show. Stunned. I laughed my head off because it was so ridiculous that they would do this. But then in the days after, more that I thought about it, it's like, you know what? The NFL is so crazy. If Michael Penix started 2025 for the Atlanta Falcons, would you be shocked? I wouldn't be shocked. What if Kirk pops his other Achilles and retires from the NFL? And then we're just going to go, that pick actually looks pretty good. So I don't know. So we criticized the heck out of the Packers when they picked Jordan Love. Don't they need a receiver? Aren't they in win now mode? And then now they got their quarterback.
Yeah.
Not exactly apples to apples, but anyway, again, I said 30-second clock and we've both blown that out of the water. So let me get to the next one, which is just the NFC North. It's obvious that the Bears had a great draft because you picked twice in the top 10. If you don't get an A, then you did something really bad. They're set up for a while. Between the Lions and the Packers, who do you think had the better draft?
Packers for sure. The Lions, to me, they picked that Giovanni Mazu in like the third or fourth round, this like British Columbia guy. Maybe he's going to be great, but they like traded up to get him. And I'm like, wait a minute. What? I mean, we didn't know about the quote unquote league's love of Michael Penix. Maybe that was the case with this British Columbian offensive lineman, but it felt unnecessary. I think they traded up a couple times. I think the Packers had a much better draft, and I've just loved what Brian Gutekunst has done there the last like two or three drafts, to go super offensive, to pick offensive linemen, like he kind of scatters them throughout the draft, and they're always very loaded with those backup offensive linemen, where when a David Bakhtiari goes down, it's almost like you don't realize it. And he was so good for them for so long. I think the Packers had a better draft than the Lions.
They picked a really excellent running back, Marshawn Lloyd.
Yeah, he's good, man.
Where they picked him was the right spot. They move on from Aaron Jones. They replace him with a mid-round running back, which is like picking a first round of almost any other position. Give me your takeaway on. So it was reported that the Vikings offered three firsts and wanted number three and then like some mid-round something back from the Patriots. That was their final offer to the Patriots. Do you believe that New England was ever going to move off of Drake May under any circumstances?
I don't think so. It feels like, and we asked this question to each other and not knowing the answer pre-draft, now we know that the Patriots are feeling like they can maybe not, you know, go to the playoffs and be a team that gets to the AFC title game this year. But we were like, do they think like they're kind of close to being like respectable? Or are they like, hey, maybe by 2027 we'll be good? We know that they, again, had a lot of retention in free agency. We mentioned that a lot more than people expected. And that apparently all the players love their new head coach, Jerod Mayo. It's not to say they hated Bill Belichick, but I mean, there was certainly some guys that maybe didn't view him as the most, gracious players coach. And that they're like, hey, this quarterback is here. I don't blame the Vikings for being that interested in Drake May, because we talked about it. It was like Drake May, just for everything that we talked about with JJ McCarthy in this offense, Drake May was like the number one, like perfect fit. And probably number two was JJ McCarthy with all the boot action stuff and things like that. So I just don't think the Patriots, now that they got that pretty hefty offer and maybe an offer reportedly from the Giants, they just said, nope, we're going to stay put. We're not going to, you know, prolong this rebuild. We're going to hope to start it right now with Drake May.
Yeah, I had really convinced myself throughout the process that the Patriots might be willing to do it because they were afraid of ruining a quarterback. But I go back to Robert Kraft when he first bought the team and he picked Drew Bledsoe, and Drew Bledsoe got them to a Super Bowl. And like, it's not hard to see Drew Bledsoe and Drake May, except for he can run a little bit more. A modern Drew Bledsoe, draft the quarterback first, build around him, made so much sense. They would have probably had to add, I don't know, Christian Darrisaw, Jordan Addison, something that you just can't give up in order to do it. And that the gap wouldn't be wide enough between May and McCarthy, and the odds aren't wide enough between May and McCarthy working out It would be worth giving up any more than they offered. But I agree with you. I don't believe there was any circumstance where they were going to do it. Okay. So just a disclaimer about all of my snark. some tongue-in-cheek, some I really mean. The draft season drives me crazy because things that get reported and things that get said, there's no accountability once the draft is over. It's just, well, who cares if that person got totally misled, and who cares if that person misevaluated the quarterbacks by five rounds, or all these reporters. As a reporter, I really like facts, and all these reporters saying things that don't come true, so it drives me crazy. So I've got a list of that. And I also understand the pressure of the insider. This team's this team's thinking that, when realistically, they're not telling anybody what they think always and forever. Okay. Here is a list of all the rumors that did not come true. This is only from the final 3 days of Pro Football Rumors. I went through these. First report, and I'm not going to say who did each one. It doesn't matter. The Bears prepared to trade the number 9 pick? No, they stayed at number 9. Jaguars exploring wide receivers turned out to be true, but the part of the report was they are attempting to move up. Not true. They moved down with the Minnesota Vikings. Teams wanting Brock Bowers will need a top 10 pick was a headline. Not true. He went 13th. The Rams are aiming to trade into the top 10. They did not trade up. The Colts are interested in trading up for a wide receiver or Brock Bowers. They sat and took a defensive end. Vikings in play for Bo Nix? Clearly not, or they would have picked him. Raiders and Cardinals discussed a trade for the number 4 pick. They may have, but they were never trading that pick and stayed with Marvin Harrison. Giants considering Penix at number 6. Nope. They picked Malik Nabers. And that's another one for me. Nailed it, that the Giants were not going to pick a quarterback. Chargers to move down? No. Chargers were not moving down. Several teams have a second round grade on Michael Penix, not the Falcons. Broncos viewed as unlikely to stay at number 12. I viewed them staying at number 12. I watched it happen. Giants could wait for a quarterback in the draft. They did not. Spencer Rattler widely thought to have a third round grade. Nope. Wide thinking. Not true. Fifth round grade. Rams could be a surprise team looking for a quarterback in the draft. No, they were certainly not. That's just 3 days of football rumors leading up to the draft. We had months to do it. So there's your old takes exposed on all those reports. Now, let me say this. The ranting, please take it for what it is. I'm mostly kidding. We had a great, great time.
It was fun.
It was so much fun. And you, sir, made it a lot of fun for everybody here, and incredibly informative, going all the way back to the combine, finding new ways to break down these quarterbacks each time. The energy was felt from you about this, where it was like you were getting as excited as everybody over here
in
Viking land as well, and really invested in this. Your knowledge of the draft, your insight, your effort, as you were just talking about, is unmatched. And I just can't thank you enough for doing this again this year. It was an absolute pleasure to have you on each and every week. And we will check in as the rookies go forward on the draft class and the decisions. But as far as weekly goes, the end of the draft. And so I cannot thank you enough.
Well, this was really fun for me. I look forward to it every single week. And like you mentioned, like trying to find new angles to cover these quarterbacks. Like you mentioned at the beginning of this episode, I think it's kind of fitting to kind of come full circle here, that we for years were like, is it going to be Trey Lance or Zach Wilson? Oh, they can't get these guys. We finally knew that they were probably going to pick a quarterback. So got to talk about the most important and most marquee position in the NFL for, 3 or 4 months. Only mentioned the other positions a little. They ultimately pick another spot in the first round, which is really interesting too. So I thank you and all the new Vikings followers I have and all the people that have reached out to say, hey, I love you coming on Purple Insider. It's definitely been an honor. And yes, I definitely want to jump back on maybe training camp or right before the season, or if there's another Ivan Pace Jr. And then after that, next draft season, because the Vikings still have that 2025 first round pick, didn't make that trade. I'm certainly already looking forward to next late January, early February to start this up again.
Why don't you end us on a football?
Football.
Football.